I was hoping we wouldn't get caught, Rhonda. Excuse my voice today. It's not swine flu. Although I am a bit worried being at Moonee Valley as a Salvation Army person that I'll be the one person who gets equine influenza. But I just have to bear with it. It's been great to work with Rhonda over the years and Joe. Joe and I are both Catholics. I told him the other day if there wasn't a Salvation Army, it'd have to be a Catholic. But I'd have to get him to give up drinking. And it's also great to see Joan Kerner sitting in the front row, who I would claim, she mightn't claim this, but I would claim as a mentor, because Joan can teach you about being audacious. And I do remember when I was just a young worker at Crossroads, the Salvation Army program, Joan set up a community reference group on youth homelessness. And she set up a community reference group, a sort of bureaucrats group, and a cabinet subcommittee. And I was invited to all three. And I had to get a specially locked filing cabinet or something. I don't think any premier has ever done this before. And I said, why have I got to go to all three? She said, you've got to go to keep them honest, because they change their story every time they shift from one committee to another. And if you're at all three, you can say, no, 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 that's not what was said at the bureaucrats group or senior officers group. That's not what was said. So that was pretty audacious too. I just want to remind you, if you need to be reminded, what things were like under the previous government, just in terms of the social circumstances of Australia. We did have a period of decreasing unemployment. Economic indicators were on the up. The government were crowing about no government debt and bigger surpluses, but seemed to have little interest in addressing social problems such as homelessness. And I think there was one major program instituted during that time called Reconnect, which was an early intervention program into youth homelessness, and that was a very effective program. But it's a trickle, or stopped a trickle of young people coming into youth homelessness because it didn't have the scope or the spread to be able to prevent youth homelessness substantially having an impact as it did. Over that period of incredible economic growth, homelessness remained the same, essentially, 100,000 people. But funding for homeless services decreased in real terms over the decade, and there was a decrease of 30,000 public housing units over that same period. And agencies were sort of struggling stoically to keep pace with what was happening despite financial pressure. I think in some ways you could say it was a demoralised sector, and peak organisations had largely been emasculated and were intimidated. So what could be done? Well, at the time, Gloria, my wife and I were running the Salvation Army at Brunswick, and we met with David McKenzie, the homelessness census taker, I like to call him because he hates that, but David and Chris Chamberlain had set up the homelessness census over a period of time, which is internationally unique. We have better data on homelessness than any other country that I've been able to establish. But we were standing in the hallway in the kitchen of the Brunswick Salvation Army Hall and reflecting on the state of the world. And we came up with two flashes. David actually sent me a serviette that we were drawing on at the time. He's got it framed on his wall, he says. I don't believe him because he wouldn't spend the money on the frame. But he did email me a copy of it. The two ideas were, one, to create a new NGO platform for change and innovation, which would be called Youth Development Australia. And we'd try and get some agencies together and form this organisation. And one of its core activities would be the creation of youth commissions into youth activities. Now, the idea was modelled on the Human Rights Commission inquiry conducted by Brian Burdekin in 1989. And that had been, I think, the most significant intervention into the issue of homelessness or youth homelessness, and remains an important historical point of reference today, I think. But it was something that had happened 20 years ago. And we'd hoped, if we could get this National Youth Commission thing going, that it would be conducted with all the rigour and thoroughness of the previous inquiry. But of course, we didn't think we'd have the legal clout. Brian could actually subpoena people, including public servants, to attend, and that's why he was so popular in the public service. And with government ministers, I'm sure, Joan. But we did want to keep independence from government with this commission. So YDA, I then went overseas to work for the Salvation Army in the UK for 3 years. And YDA was launched in a modest way in 2005 while I was still overseas. But the NYC lay dormant for a while. It was an idea whose time hadn't yet come. Late in 2006, Ian Darling from the Caledonia Foundation, Ian is a documentary maker as well as whatever he does to earn a living. And he'd embedded a team in the Oasis service in King's Cross in Sydney to follow the lives of some homeless young people in inner Sydney. They wanted some solid intellectual evidence to go with the film. You know, a film moves people emotionally, and that's a good thing, and it should be done. But he felt that there was needed to be a policy component, and they wanted a report of some sort. Now, they called on David because he is one of the leading homelessness researchers in the country, and he proposed the notion of the NYC Commission, or the National Youth Commission, and he went off to COST doing it. He needed my help, I think, in costing it because it was too cheap. we found later into the process. But look, Ian and the Caledonia Foundation were fabulous and they funded us to conduct the commission. And David likes to call it a good example of the positive practice of postmodernism, because we're conducting the work of an inquiry. We don't have any legal status. We didn't have an organisation. We had a banner, very nice, that rolled up and we could carry around everywhere. And off we went. Now, Rhonda's called it a citizen's inquiry, and she's quite correct, because the only mandate, the only strength we had was the people who participated in the inquiry. Without their participation, it would have been a significant disaster. We tried to choose four commissioners who'd been in the sector for some time, so we chose ourselves first, David. Commissioner is one of the highest ranks in the Salvation Army. I'd always felt like being a commissioner, even if it was a self-named one. But if we were going to model ourselves on Brian Burdekin, we might as well call ourselves commissioners as well. And so there was Commissioner Associate Professor David McKenzie. We asked Narelle Clay from New South Wales, who is the CEO of Southern Youth and Family Services. And Narelle is a long-standing leader in the sector over many years. She agreed to be one of the commissioners. And for the fourth commissioner, we had Father Wally Dethlefs, who was one of the three commissioners in the Burdekin Inquiry. And Wally was from Brisbane and also had a very long history in working with homeless young people. So off we set. We set up, we employed two staff, one mainly to do the organisation and one to gather the information as it came in. There was actually a third staff, and very important, because we took a transcript of every day of every hearing, so that we had people's, we had a transcript word for word that we could go back to and refer to and work over as our policy information base. So we had 21 days of hearings. We had 2 days in Sydney and Brisbane and then across capitals and regional Australia. 319 individuals gave formal evidence at these hearings. And they were homeless young people, they were parents, they were workers in the sector. I think a couple of government departments gave evidence in the hearing and about seven sent in written submissions, which I thought was good. We were heavily attended by the Commonwealth government, and there was a FACSEA representative at every one of the 21 days of hearings. But, you know, that was part of the process of engaging with government to pass the information. What we were collecting was information from the community that needed to be heard. So I think I said 319 individuals, 91 written submissions, including seven from government departments, and we held four policy workshops. Having got the information in, we really wanted to take it back out to the sector and sort of test what people were saying or whether we were hearing what they were saying accurately, because we really didn't want to misrepresent anybody. I think that pretty much followed the model of the Burdekin Inquiry. I can't remember them doing policy workshops. But it was the four of us who were responsible for the inquiry and the report. We were open-minded but not empty-minded, so we did need to test what we said with other people, because we all have views and we wanted to make sure that it wasn't our views that were predominating. And we were as open as possible to all the experience brought to our attention and to some of the more creative ideas, because people came with some absolutely unbelievable ideas. But, you know, they came from their own experience, which gave them some validity. Outcomes, we wrote a report with 80 recommendations based on the evidence that we'd received. And we wanted to get that down to something that was bite-sized. So we developed a roadmap of 10 key strategic areas for action. Now, the NYC inquiry wasn't research as such, but it was research-like. And it was concerned with constructing policy ideas. Didn't have the power to decide policy, which is a government responsibility. But we wanted to be able to enter the policy debate with some vigour and rigour. The report was released in the first week of April 2008, on Tuesday, April the 8th. It was launched by Minister Tanya Plibersek. The new Labor government embraced the report, and on Thursday, April the 10th, the Oasis film was broadcast in prime time by the ABC. And then afterwards, there was a panel show with Rhonda, Tanya Plibersek, myself, and Paul Moulds, who was the director then of the Oasis Centre. The film was seen by 1.1 million Australians, which is a huge audience for the ABC, and it certainly had a big effect on the community. And I think it's here only right that we thank the ABC, not only for the film, but in fact, they took a very strategic approach to the publication of the report, the showing of the film, the panel show afterwards, and ABC radio and TV nationally certainly supported it, as did other stations. But I think from the ABC, it was a strategic response and strategic support that helped us get our message out to as many communities as possible. Now, there's a number of things in the roadmap, I think I will go through some of the things in the roadmap, Rhonda. The roadmap on responding to youth homelessness set up a national framework and a national action plan. It was an aspirational national horizon. Now, I am probably a realist bordering occasionally on cynicism. David's Pollyanna. I hope he's here somewhere for me to insult personally. No, David is such an optimist. Nothing's going to stop him. And he said we should be aiming to eliminate homelessness. And I'm thinking, oh, Lord, how can I give this man some sense? But in our debate, it's true. What are we working for? We're actually working to eliminate homelessness. And if your aspirational goals aren't to do that, well, then maybe it's time to get out of working with people. We actually wanted to set some big guidelines. So we decided to eliminate youth homelessness by 2030 and develop a long-term national plan and strategy to achieve that. We had some specific long-term and short to medium-term national targets. It was a youth-centred focus for service provision and programs. And we were asking for a strong review, monitoring and accountability from government, transparent. I mean, if you look at some of the problems we have with Job Network, partly they're because there is no transparent basis for evaluating Job Network. You know, it has been let free in the community, managed by a department, with no accountability other than to that department, who have no transparent goals or data collections or anything that you can get out and say, this is working or this is not working. So I think we wanted to make sure that in homelessness, where we have a better record, that there was certainly accurate, effective data collection so that we could monitor and be accountable for the delivery of the programs. So we set up that national framework and action plan. Secondly, the issue that came up time and time again was more affordable housing for young people. So we wanted the development of an affordable housing strategy and with investment in public and community housing. We wanted incentives for private capital to produce private affordable housing stock. It's another point where David and I had some vigorous discussions and the other two umpired. But largely again, because I think David believes that there is a possibility to access capital in the private market, and he may be right. And certainly it's something that we would want some incentives for. And we want a specific attention to the needs of homeless and disadvantaged young people. Thirdly, in the roadmap, we wanted to refocus service provision on building and resourcing communities of service. And by communities of service, we mean those networks that already exist in the community but aren't funded, aren't resourced. You know, it may be set up around local government areas, but how do we assist people to work together in partnership And we, in fact, in tightly financially structured budgets today, expect basically workers and community members and volunteers to do all the partnership work as an add-on. Yet it's part of how we should do business, and we can't expect that there isn't some injection of funding into this public sort of infrastructure in communities. So that we push the notion of resourcing communities of services, particularly around homelessness, but more broadly. Fourthly, we wanted to prevent homelessness by supporting at-risk families. About one-third of SAP clients are families. Some 55,000 children pass through the Supported Accommodation Assistance Program each year. And there's one tiny Commonwealth pilot program, the Home Advice Program, that works with them. We wanted the government to progressively expand home advice up to about a $60 or $90 million program, which we felt would give coverage across the country. Fifthly, we wanted to resource early intervention for at-risk young people. The Reconnect program of 100 services is effective, but it only reaches about one-third of homeless young people at risk. Its geographic coverage is incomplete. And there is evidence that early intervention is largely responsible for the decrease from 26,000 in 2001 to 22,000 in 2006 in the numbers of youth homeless. It was the only reduction in the homelessness census was in teenage homelessness. And looking at all sorts of factors like, you know, lower unemployment and all sorts of things, we had to come back to the fact that early intervention was working, that Reconnect as a program was working. It would work better if there was national coverage. Sixthly, we wanted a new national approach for care and protection. You know, state care and protection, inadequate across the country, frighteningly inadequate in some states. And young people who are in the care of the state end up significantly overrepresented in young people who are homeless for long periods of time. And that was picked up in the Herriot inquiry, in Brian Burdekin's inquiry. It's been picked up in just about every report since. So we need to respond to that effectively. Seventh, we wanted accessible supported accommodation in all communities. During the years that no new programs were funded, homelessness shifted or changed or grew in particular places. We wanted to make the location of services meet the data that was collected in the census. Eighth, we wanted to redevelop employment, drug and alcohol, mental health programs for homeless youth. One of the interesting things after Burdekin was when some funding went into youth homelessness, suddenly everybody was working with the young homeless. And I can understand that. You know, here were people working with young people with mental illness or young people with drug and alcohol issues. There weren't funded services in 89. So if you could find a homelessness link, you might get some funding. We wanted to see that those services were resourced adequately. We wanted a new form of youth housing linked to education, training and employment. If young people who are homeless drop out of employment or don't get baseline employment skills necessary, education necessary to find employment, they're really shot for life. So we wanted to make sure that something was happening there. And we wanted postvention support. Now, it was interesting because I think that the Rudd government has showed a particular interest in homelessness. The first thing Kevin Rudd insisted that his members do was visit a homeless shelter and a school, which is something that I think is very, very, he should be applauded for. When the Green paper came out, we weren't so ecstatic. I'd have to say that there were issues in the Green paper that seemed to demean the work of people in the sector who'd worked for a long time. It may have just been in the writing, but we didn't feel the Green paper was a way forward. And with many other people in the sector, the Commission worked closely and collaboratively to get government to change their mind on some things. The White paper is actually a very impressive document, and it gives us a foundation for moving forward. It's unfortunate with the global financial crisis that there are unprecedented demands on services, but I still think we need to work on the White paper as it stands to get the agreements right in states, to get the policy settings correct, so that we can move on in homelessness. We also do need to deal with the increasing number of families and others who are presenting just at the moment. But I think that we've got an opportunity to move forward now. And I think that the challenge will be maybe to, we'll restructure and think towards meeting as a commission supporting the government's halving of homelessness by 2020 and the provision of services to rough sleepers. And I know that within the Salvation Army, rather than write a white paper response, we've decided to write a strategic document that says how we'll work towards achieving white paper outcomes. Okay, the model. Go back to the NYC model. We like to think of the whole process with the film and with the report as a triangle. The head of the triangle is the report, the mind, the intellectual effort, the evidence, the arguments, the policy ideas. That's the head of our triangle. The heart is the feature film. The heart of our triangle was the film, the Oasis, moved people's hearts, reaching the community, getting a large number of people to turn their attention to help move politicians' minds. And the other one, I'm not quite sure whether to call it the mouth or the arms and the legs, but it's the less well-known component of the process, but no less important. And that was about communication with the community, with the media, and in government circles. And about one third of our budget at the NYC was spent on the communications issue, getting the story out. We got a copy of the Oasis DVD into every school, accompanied by a simplified model of the report, and we got education departments to work on school packs so that teachers could use it. We worked with two very competent PR communication companies leading up to the launch and for several months afterwards. And I think that this is really important. We would have, in many ways, there are some editorial faults in the report, and there are things that, you know, we should have thought, oh, well, if we'd only spend a bit more on that or a bit more on this. It was the communication that was important. It's not much good having a great process where people stand up and want their voices to be heard that you don't communicate out there in the sector. So it was getting the three parts of the triangle working together. YDA will continue to support young people in Australia. The National Youth Commission will sort of stay in existence until I think the COAG agenda is sorted out with states and that there are national and state plans in place, and we'll keep digging away until that point because we still have a bit of cred, I think, from the whole process. But boy, couldn't you have some great commissions, Rhonda, into a whole lot of issues just using the model. And if anybody's really interested, we thought about a million. We thought about Indigenous, and then we thought, no, it's not our mandate. But we did think about the issue of young people, transitions through school and beyond, those young people not in employment, education and training, especially with the government's move to the earning or learning policy. We thought that might be a good one. Young people with disabilities, young people with mental illness issues. Pick an issue. But I think the community will support you if you get out there and try and make some things happen. And thank you, those of you who gave evidence, and thank you that nobody exposed the Emperor as having no real legal clothes. Because actually, Rhonda, I think we almost got away with it.